when were you first drawn to Hebrew?
Okay. At my secondary school education, I took the classical route, so to speak. So we had Latin and Greek as part of our curriculum. And at a certain moment, the mission of our denomination, the Netherlands Reformed Congregations in those days, they were doing Bible translation work in Africa, in southeastern Nigeria. It was a language called Iji. It already had a New Testament, and there was an interest in the Old Testament. So when I was still a student, finishing my African linguistics program, the mission approached me and asked me whether I would be willing to work with that project. Of course, there's a whole lot more involved than that. You have to talk about callings and everything. But at the end of a lot of time of thinking and praying, I became the coordinator, exegete for that project. So that was going to be an Old Testament project. So I knew I had to know Hebrew in order to do that. So I went to the University of Utrecht and I took a year and a half courses in Hebrew and Aramaic and Old Testament exegesis and so on. So that was kind of my first acquaintance with the Hebrew language. And, you know, I was a linguist already. I had a master's in linguistics, and that made it so much more interesting studying Hebrew, because at the university, people were learning Hebrew in kind of the traditional way, using kind of Latin grammar and things like that. And I, right from the beginning, I was inclined to look at it from a linguistic point of view, which was fascinating. And all of a sudden, I realized that there's a lot of work to be done from a more contemporary linguistic point of view. So then when I was in Nigeria, I got the opportunity to attend a workshop organized by Dr. Bob Longacre on discourse structure. He had just finished his research on the Joseph story, and he was presenting that during a six-week workshop. And meanwhile, I was there with others, you know, also working on the discourse structure of the language that we were working with. So it was really exciting to learn more, to learn Hebrew from that perspective.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed every minute of that course. And after that, I also went on. And then, of course, you know, I worked with the project. We went through the entire Old Testament. So, and then I became a translation consultant later, working with other projects. Many of them were Old Testament projects. So, yeah, if you go through the Old Testament so many times, you know, with Bible translators, it really helps your Hebrew.
Yeah.
Yes.
I bet. Yeah, so speaking of Bible translation, give us a little bit of your background and your history and work in Bible translation. What kinds of projects? How long have you been doing this? And what capacity?
Yeah, I think we started in 1983. I was sent out as a missionary to work with the Iji translation. Later, two other dialects followed, the Aza and Ikwo dialects that were kind of very closely related. And we continued working on those three languages. Until 1990, when we left for health reasons, we went back to the Netherlands, where we were from. I continued working with the team from a distance, but then I had extra time and I joined the UBS, the United Bible Societies, and they made me a translation consultant to work with projects in Guinea. So next to Nigeria, I started visiting Guinea and working with teams there, and later on they made me consultant in Tanzania. So after 15 years working with Guinea, I started working with projects in Tanzania. Meanwhile, I had been involved in other things like software development. You know, working with the team, I'm not really a software developer, but I'm a very impatient guy who is not able to wait for somebody else to do it. And I had learned some very basic programming techniques early on. So I started creating some of my own software to work with my own teams. Eventually, that was shared with colleagues who thought that was an interesting tool. And they asked me, you know, to add some features. It became kind of, you know, something developed beyond what I had ever thought it would be. And that was actually the first version of Paratext.
Wow.
And later in 1996, UBS asked me whether I was willing to kind of hand it over to them so that they could continue working on the tool and make it a tool that could be used all over the world with other languages and so on. And I thought that was a great idea. So I've been involved in software development a bit And then working with the team on an Old Testament, I saw that, you know, translators really need more resources. And already in the beginning, I started creating word lists, you know, looking at some of the Old Testament key terms and writing descriptions so that the teams could use these. And then at a certain moment, I started becoming interested in a PhD. So I went to the Free University in Amsterdam, and they had Jan de Waard was professor there on behalf of the Netherlands Bible Society. And I asked him, you know, whether there is something we could do, you know, to do more research that could lead to a PhD on Hebrew key terms, especially. And then he said, well, you know, Lowenides Dictionary has been finished recently, but there's a group in South Africa who are going to do the same thing for the Old Testament, kind of based on Lowenides domain, but then on Old Testament Hebrew. Would you be interested in joining that group? And maybe, you know, your work could become a pilot that could lead into a dissertation. Said, okay. So I reached out to these people and they said, yeah, you're welcome to join us. And they gave me the letter Chet to work on. And so here's the letter Chet, just start working on it. And here's Lowenides Dictionary and try to see what you can do. And I started doing that. And oh boy, I was frustrated right from the beginning because I felt there was something not completely right. Maybe it was just Hebrew rather than Greek. I didn't want to say anything bad about the Greek, but I thought this is not going to work for Hebrew. Part of the problems with Lowenides Dictionary is that they give you only one or two references for every sense. And I found easy that it is very easy to do it that way. You know, you define a sense for a word, and then you find some references that really match that sense properly. But I said from the beginning, if this is something to be useful for Bible translators, you have to deal with every scripture reference, because you want to link it to the Hebrew text. So, and then I found out that, boy, that is not easy to do because, you know, many words are polysemous and they have senses that are related, but there's a long scale of different senses. And it's very hard to determine where one sense begins, ends, and the other begins. So I said, this has to be done differently. So I kind of gave up that lexicographical effort for a while. And I started looking into this, looking at Lowenides domains to see what was really needed in Hebrew. And that kind of led into my dissertation. In that dissertation, I came up, well, with this kind of an alternative way of doing things, distinguishing between lexical meanings, contextual meanings, lexical semantic domains, contextual semantic domains, started thinking about metaphors. So that led to my dissertation, and then my boss at UBS said, you know, if you think you know how to do it, why don't you go ahead and lead a project that would become the Hebrew equivalent of a Lowenides Dictionary. So I got involved in, I was a translation consultant, I got involved in development of resources, and I got involved in a little bit of software development on the side. So those are kind of the three areas, you know, that if you talk about a career, those three elements are featuring in there. I was doing this from more, well, I wouldn't call a structuralist, maybe a linguistic agnostic perspective to do it. Of course, Lowenides work was based on structuralism and the componential analysis of meaning and so on. So at that time, I hadn't really thought about that. But then I shared it with some people that I worked with in the field. And one of them said, hey, do you realize that what you're doing is cognitive? And so I said, oh, really? So then I started reading, you know, books on cognitive linguistics, and I said, oh boy, that fits like a glove, you know, that goes very well. So actually, I rewrote a copy of my dissertation, adding some references to cognitive linguistics into it, but I never published that either. But then in the articles that I published, slowly but surely, cognitive linguistics started playing a bigger role. And it really helped me, you know, in my research and in my lexicographical work. I realized different moments that had to go back and redo certain entries. But yeah, in the end, it helped a lot.
So going back to doing your PhD, why were you interested in particular in key terms? I mean, out of all the things that you could have done regarding Hebrew, what drew your interest to that?
The translators that I was working with, they were struggling. What I discovered working in Africa, we lived in the middle of a village, you know, in the bush somewhere, a very isolated place. And I saw right from the beginning that these people had, you know, so much affinity with the Old Testament in many ways. Things that I, as a Westerner, had difficulty grasping. They they understood it right from the beginning. And parts of the Bible that I thought were very boring were actually very fascinating to them, like a book like Leviticus with all those details about sacrifices, even some of those long lists of ancestors in First Chronicles, they thought were fascinating because they only knew the name of their father and grandfather and maybe, you know, one generation beyond. But just the idea that people would have long lists of generations, you know, spanning centuries, for them, that was fantastic. It was totally fascinating. So, and I discovered, you know, that those concepts in the Old Testament, we really need to discuss those concepts in detail with the translators and help them to really wrap their brain around it and find the proper equivalence. So, yeah, key terms, I think, was crucial to begin with. Yeah.
So you have a wide range of interests, it seems like, from software to linguistics to Hebrew. So why is a lexicon important enough to dedicate your life to it? And why do you think it's important for the work of Bible translation in particular?
Well, you know, as you see, I don't dedicate my whole life only to the lexicon. I don't think I would have survived that. it is, well, you know, you need a break from time to time. Let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. I would not be able to work on an entry, you know, from 8 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That is,
yeah.
So I'm glad that I could mix it with other activities. But, you know, it turns out to be fascinating. I never thought that working on a dictionary could be fascinating. I thought it would be an incredibly boring job. But it turns out to be fascinating because there is so much in it, you know, through a proper semantic analysis of the language. You discover so much of the thinking of the people and the culture behind the text, the worldview behind the text. And that in turn gives you a better understanding of the meaning of individual words and how they fit in their context. So it opens the door to a tremendously fascinating world and really helps understand the Bible way better. So that in the first place was important for me personally. And then working mainly in Africa, I've usually worked in Africa with teams in different parts of the continent. You know, I saw who useful that was. And I also discovered in my discussion with translators that I could really trust their insights. Sometimes their insights were more reliable than mine. You know, you come there with a degree and you think you know something, but then you start working with the translators and you see how they are going through the text, how they are reading the English text they were working from and how they were actually, you know, finding proper equivalence in their language. That was so fascinating. And they read things in the text that I would have never read into that. Can I give you an example?
Please.
There is this famous text in the Old Testament, which is found three times, that you're not supposed to cook a young goat in the milk of its mother.
Yeah.
And of course, people have been talking about that text. And the entire law of kosher food is based on it and so on and so forth. But this translator that I work with, he created the draft and then he gave me the text at a certain moment and I started reading it. And I said, wow, what have you done? So in the milk of his mother, he interpreted that during the time that it still drinks the milk of the mother. So he translated that into a period, the time that it depends on the mother. And then all of a sudden, the text got a different meaning. So you're not supposed to kill a young goat during the time that it still depends on its mother's milk. And then it became a law of mercy. And I'm not saying that that was there are still some problems with that exegesis, but it was still fascinating. And I shared it with colleagues who were equally fascinated. And I learned from that, you know, if I want to understand the Old Testament, you know, if we give the people the right tools and the right resources and stimulate them to think for themselves, they can discover truth in the Bible that I would never be able to discover from my Western ivory tower, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. Amen. Now, just out of curiosity, why did you choose to call it a dictionary instead of a lexicon, your project?
Yeah. No reason, actually. No reason. Okay. I mean, maybe it was a little bit of ignorance in those days that I didn't realize that there's a difference between the two.
Okay.
So it just got that name and we never changed it. But yeah, lexicon would be a better term because you deal with a limited corpus of data based on a certain text. So a lexicon would actually probably be a better term.
Okay.
Yes.
So now that you've been working on SDBH for two decades, I guess over two decades, what are some ideas you might add to your original paper from 2000?
Yeah, I would rewrite the whole thing, you know. Of course, some of the basics are still correct, but I would really bring in what I had learned from cognitive linguistics. And in many ways, what I learned when I studied cognitive linguistics, it confirmed what I had already written in my dissertation. So I never really had to go back and change the basics of my conclusions. They are still valid. But I learned a lot more.
Yeah. And for those who are listening, could you briefly define cognitive linguistics for people who may not have studied that before?
Yes. Traditional linguistics, so to speak, is kind of looking at language as a structure, as a given, as a methodology, as a tool, as a machine in itself. And the focus is more on finding out the structure. How does it work? And more linguists were saying, okay, we have to look at the language itself. And if you want to be good linguists, we have to forget about other disciplines, academic disciplines like psychology and theology, but just look at language from a linguistic point of view. And that was necessary. And it really helped to do that for a while. But it's not enough in the end. Cognitive linguistics looks at language as a product of the mind. The idea is that speakers of a language, they look at the world around them and they try to see structures, they make sense out of that in their minds, and then they assign words to the concepts that they see in order to be able to talk about it. In traditional linguistics, there's a lot of focus on what we hear and what we learn when we hear another language. You study the sound structure, you study the word structure, you study the syntax. And then when I studied African linguistics, there was lots of attention on those disciplines. But in the end, there was hardly any time for semantics, because semantics in those days was seen as too subjective. Not very interesting. Of course, cognitive linguistics starts with semantics. It's all about meaning. And from meaning, in the end, you start speaking. And of course, meaning has to be put into words and sentences and so on and so forth. But the primary concern is meaning. And of course, as Bible translators, you know, meaning is more important than anything else. Once you have the meaning figured out, everything else will be easier to finish the translation anyway. The idea is that I want the Hebrew language to speak for itself. We have a bit of a problem with Hebrew because it's a dead language. It's no longer speaking in the same form. Even modern Hebrew is very different. So the problem is, you know, if I were to study a living language, I can interview people and I can find out how these people think and why they're saying certain things in a certain way. In the case of Hebrew, you cannot do that. You only have the Bible and maybe a few other inscriptions and other things, but there's not much beyond the Bible. So yeah, you have to let the data speak for itself as much as possible. Of course, I am a Westerner and my worldview is very different and I can make a lot of mistakes when I interpret the Hebrew text. So cognitive linguistics allows me to let the text speak for itself. And there are several ways, you know, you can look at the Hebrew data to figure out what the semantic domains were in those days, how people looked at the world, how they divided the world into different elements. And that really helps a lot. And especially because Hebrew is a language that is full of poetry, and poetry has lots of features like parallelisms. And so those parallelisms can help a lot in doing that. So, yeah, and that makes me feel better because, you know, I don't trust my own views, but I trust the biblical text and I like the text to speak for itself. And through the text, I want to discover the underlying structures and worldviews.
Could you give us an example of a place where, if the authors of BDB, for example, had been thinking in terms of cognitive linguistics, how they could have improved an entry or improved something that some of their work, maybe on a particular word or something like that?
One of the terms that I believe that has always been misunderstood, especially by some of the early lexicographers, was a term like chesed, loving kindness, all of those ideas. Those terms are completely, wrongly chosen, because that's not what it is. I figured out through my research that chesed only happens if there's a relationship between people. It's impossible to show chesed to a perfect stranger because there is no relation between the two. Chesed requires a relationship like a family relation or a covenant relation or a host and guest translation relation, or things like that. And actually, it has nothing to do with kindness. It has nothing to do with love either. Of course, it's easier to show kindness, to show chesed to a person whom you love. But love as such has nothing to do with it. When Abraham tells his wife, Sarah, hey, we're here in Egypt, and they may actually kill me there. So show chesed to me and tell everybody that you're my sister. Then actually, Abraham is asking Sarah to lie on behalf for his sake. And maybe they loved one another, and I hope they did, but that's not necessarily guaranteed in those cultures. You know, marriage is more like a contract. It's an agreement. You do it. I remember having a discussion with a number of students that I was teaching. It was an international group. And I asked them, I said, hey, what, for instance, one of these days you get a message about your brother-in-law and you find out that your brother-in-law has embezzled money or he has killed someone or something bad. What would you do? And there was a fellow Dutch guy there and he stood up and said, you know, I would grab my phone and call the police right away. And there was an African student there as well. And he was kind of looking at him. He said, are you crazy? He's your brother-in-law. Right? That kind of the feeling of loyalty and certain responsibilities. You do certain things not because you love the person. If your brother-in-law comes to you and asks for money, even if he's a jerk, you will still give him the money because he's your brother-in-law. Right? And that is chesed. And it's very well understood in Africa where I worked. And I'm sure it's very well understood in many rural cultures. But many of the, I don't think Brown Driver Briggs and Gazinis had that in mind at all. Chesed is a two-way street in principle. Like if there's a relation between God and Israel, then both are supposed to show chesed to one another. And God will be their God and they will be his people and they will follow his laws. Well, it became clear soon enough that Israel was not doing a great job in showing chesed. At a certain moment, the text says your chesed is like the morning dew, you know, it comes and goes, it's not to be trusted. But then the Bible says God's chesed is le'olam, is forever. And all of a sudden it became clear there was a discrepancy. Israel failed in showing chesed, and God was faithful in showing chesed. And God could have decided, because it is a two-way street, to say, well, if Israel doesn't show chesed, then I'm not going to show chesed in return. And because effectively the covenant would be broken if one of the parties doesn't stick to it. But then God, in his mercy, and there's the word, he decides, I'm going to show people what chesed really is, and I'm going to keep showing chesed le'olam, forever. So in many ways, you know, you could say that chesed becomes an act of mercy. Although I would never translate it that way, because God considers it chesed. It is his loyalty, even though the other party is not loyal. So in the Septuagint, you see that they understood that concept and they translated chesed almost consistently, with elios, which is mercy. And that's how it came in. Although in some of the earlier books, like in Genesis, you see that there are also places where the Septuagint translated the word with dikaiosyne, righteousness. And that really is way more in line with the real meaning of chesed. You do things because it's right to do it. So, but yeah, it's the Septuagint that brought in the idea of elios. And in at least, well, the majority of cases, that's what they're using. And that's how misericordia came in.
That's fascinating. Thank you for that example. So I'm really interested in the workflow of how you do this work. What's your daily process? I love to hear the details, so feel free to give as much detail as you can.
This is an original work in the sense that we are not building on existing dictionaries. And because we have a different methodology and a different linguistic background, it would also not be wise to do that. So in principle, the work is done on the basis of the text. We start with the concordance, and we go through the concordance, you know, and we look at all the different passages where a particular word is found. And of course, we look at the Hebrew to begin with, but also since we are working for Bible translators, we also have about 8 English translations open, and we look at those as well, just to see, you know, what translations have done with it, because you want to evaluate the translations. We don't want to follow them, but we want to evaluate them. And if they have a different choice, sometimes we want to find out and explain also in a footnote why certain translations made a different choice. So we go through the Hebrew, and then we try to figure out the different lexical meanings. Yeah, there's a tool that I developed that can be used for that. You can just, you have a list of references, you can drag a reference to a box, and the moment you do that, it creates a different lexical meaning, and you put in kind of a basic definition, not really a full definition, but just not just a gloss, you know, not just a gloss in English or whatever, because that doesn't help. Glosses come with their own baggage. There should be a bit of a definition there. And when we see different lexical or different contextual meanings, then we add those. Like this morning, I was working on the word shelem, peace offering. And, I found out that there's about 80 plus occurrences of it, and it always has the same basic lexical meaning of this offering of well-being. You do that because you're happy, you're thankful, or you want to pay a vow or something along those lines. But then I looked at the different context, and then I found out, okay, this is something, there's the law says something about this. Okay, so I created the contextual meaning, law, saying regulations about peace offerings. And then I saw that there are animals are being slaughtered. So I created another contextual meaning for animal. And then I saw that there are pieces of the animal that are involved. The animal is cut up and certain parts, you know, are eaten, certain parts are sacrificed. So I said, okay, body of the animal plays a role. And then I found out that the animal has to be without blemish. So I added another contextual meaning for those verses where that stood out. Then I found out that, oh, priests are bringing the sacrifice. Okay. Oh, priests are actually eating part of the sacrifice. Okay. And slowly but surely I found out, okay, here, it is a joyous occasion. So, okay, I added a contextual meaning for joy and grief and so on and so forth. So I went through all those resources, through all those references. And then in the end, I had enough ammunition to write a definition because all those different contextual meanings showed important aspects of the word. And then I wrote a definition that kind of brings in all that information that I found, and then you start polishing it and so on and so forth. You look at synonyms to make sure which lexical domain is it part of, because most synonymic expressions are also automatically part of the same lexical semantic domain. So in this way, you start fleshing out things. And of course, yeah, in certain cases, certain words are very, very common and they occur, well, thousands of times, and that's a very tedious job. This one was 80 plus, so that was doable. So I could do that in one morning quite easily. So I have a tool to do this. I also use a database called the ETCBC database, developed by Professor Abe Talstra at the Free University. We have access to that, and this helps. Like, for instance, if I'm looking at a verb, I can just press a button and it will divide the references based on some of the syntactic features. Like if I have a verb, then it will give me all the different objects that come with that verb. Or I can get all the different subjects that go with it. Or I can look at the valencies of the verb. Like a verb is used with this preposition and a prepositional phrase and so on and so forth. So that information not always reliable. Some of those distinctions don't always help, but it gives me a bit of an overview on how the word is used, and it really helps sometimes with the semantic analysis. At the end, you know, I have a check that says, okay, did all the references in the concordance find their way into the dictionary? Is everything there? Is the semantic domain correct? There's all kinds of things you can do. So that really helps clean up the database pretty fast.
So if I'm correct, you are categorizing every single reference that uses that word?
Yes. Every.
So it's going to be tagged in the database under the correct domain.
Yes. We have given every Hebrew word a number. And so that is a number that not only refers to the word, but also some of the morphemes. Like if you say bereshit, be and reshit are treated as two different words. So every word has a code So, and you can find that code back in the dictionary. So you can work it in both ways. If you're in the text, you know where to find the word in the dictionary and vice versa.
Yeah. So do you ever reference other lexicons in the process? And how does that help or not help?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in the case of hapax legomenon, or some of those words where the context doesn't give you enough of a clue.
Right. Yeah.
I have access to those materials, to the dictionaries, but also to commentaries, of course, and I use them wherever there is a need, like the Anchor Yale commentary and the Word commentary and the Nicot and a few other things that I have in my Logos package. So I look at those things, but primarily in cases where, you know, you don't have enough information in the context to work with, or you see that, for instance, one particular Bible translation has chosen something else and you want to find out what was the reason. Did they actually base it on the Septuagint or the Vulgate or the Syriac, or there is some emendation behind it? So in most of those cases, we put also footnotes to say, okay, this is what this group of translations has, but these guys have chosen for another reading of the text. So we try to put that as much as we can.
Okay.
But then we are not looking at all the academic research that has ever been done about Word, because, you know, there's so much has been written and many of those suggestions never made it into a translation. So we are serving Bible translators. So if one article has never made it into a translation, we just conclude that, oh, well, probably it's not worth it to mention it.
Yeah.
That's a pragmatic consideration, and maybe it's not always fair, but it's workable. Mm-hmm.
All right. So give us a little bit of your background in programming. You've talked about paratext. So, and for the listeners who are programming oriented, what languages and platforms are you working with on the front and back end of SDBH? And also maybe, you know, what kind of programming language did you build your tool in?
Well, software developers among the audience will not be impressed, but I was in the US in 1985 for my first computer course taught by SAL. And then I found this little booklet about a program called PTP that had been designed by SAL programmers as a programming language to work especially with text. It was pretty straightforward. It was a DOS program, but it worked beautifully. And I went back to Nigeria and I started working, you know, with the teams there. And, you know, yeah, sometimes you need a little break to do something. So I started playing with that tool. And then, you know, I started, is there anything that this tool can do to make my work easier? So, and yes, there were ways. So it became a reference tool. I got access to copies of RSV, NIV, and the Good News Bible. I got a copy of a Hebrew text. I had to design fonts for the Hebrew text in those screens that hardly had enough pixels to do it. That was really a challenge. But so I started putting a tool together that made it possible, you know, for a Bible translator to consult the source text and different translations to do it. And that was, and I called it paratext at a certain moment. It was very simple. But then Katie Barnwell of SAL, she saw it demoed somewhere. And she said, wow, that's an interesting tool. And she invited me to come to Dallas. And she said, hey, this is a tool that has promise, and we would love to use it and support it. But if it's in PTP, we cannot do it. You would have to rewrite it in Visual Basic. I said, well, I can do that, but I know nothing about Visual Basic. And she said, well, no, no problem. We'll teach you. So I was there for 3 weeks, and I got a copy of the official Basic installed on my computer, and somebody showed me how it worked. And they started working on this. And slowly but surely, I was able to recreate the whole thing in Visual Basic. And I've never developed much beyond Visual Basic. I mean, even now, the tool that I've written for this dictionary work is completely written in Visual Basic. It's a lot easier now with lots of paratext components that have been released as separate components as libraries, so I can pull that in. It's a lot easier. But it's primarily Visual Basic. I learned a little bit of PHP to create the first websites for SDBH, but at this moment, I have given it into the hands of a professional developer. And if you go to marble.bible, which is kind of the new website where all the the resources are, like the Hebrew and the Greek dictionary, then yeah, I couldn't even tell you how this guy is putting it all together. But for myself, I have never grown much beyond Visual Basic, and I'm sure that's not of interest for any serious developer. But it does the job to me for me, and I'm happy with it.
Yeah, that's great. So speaking, you mentioned a developer. How many staff or volunteers are working on SDBH with you?
Well, when we started, it was officially launched in 2003. We started with a workshop, and we had a team of people that my boss at UBS had brought together, several Hebrew scholars. So there were about four or five or six people. And we divided the work into the letters of the alphabet, and this one got a bet, and the other got the gimel, and so on. And some of them, they started working on it, and some of them found a time to continue working with me, like Professor Ennio Müller from Brazil. He has been with me for many, many years. But others, well, they found out that they were too busy, or in the end, they said, you know, yeah, this approach, I'm not sure whether it works for me. It just didn't work out for them. And so people came and left. But at this moment, I'm the only one left.
Oh, okay.
But people like Graham Ogden, he worked on the Tzadeh and the Kof, and Ennio worked on the Bet and the Dalet. Matthew Enste from Australia worked on the Gimel, and many people worked on lots of entries. But most of the time, I've been working at it alone, especially for the last maybe 6-7 years.
Okay. So you anticipate finishing it at the end of this year, is that correct?
Well, there's different levels. There's a lexical analysis and there's a contextual analysis. What I want to make sure is that by the end of this year, if I can pull it off, that the lexical analysis is completely finished. That means that every word has, you know, the semantic analysis where the different lexical meanings are distinguished, and with definitions and glosses so that people can start using it. Now, of course, I'm saying that I'm kind of dreading the day that I'll have to start with some of those small prepositions like the be and the le and the ke. I'm not even sure whether it's worth it. It probably is, but, you know, words that occur 20,000 times or something like that, that's going to be tedious. I'm not even sure whether my approach is going to make a difference there. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around that. How can I handle those small relationals? So I'm not sure whether some of those will ever be done. But in principle, we have to go through most of the words before the end of this year so that people can have a tool that they can use and that the localizers can also finalize the localization. The contextual meanings is a different thing. UBS has not released that yet on an open license, and it is less advanced. So even if it were released, it would be less useful. About 72% has been done. So, but by the end of this year, the main part of the lexicon should be very close to being finished if all goes well.
So the right now, only part of it, the lexical meanings, are released under an open license.
Yes.
That's what you're saying? Okay.
Yes.
All right. So they still need to decide on the contextual later.
Yes. I mean, that's a decision for UBS to make. And I'm trying to stimulate them as much as possible to release as much as they can. But all these things take time. But the most important part, I think, has been released. And I think that is, yeah, useful. And that's also the part that has been localized. Because if you really have to localize every word with all the contextual meanings, it kind of triples the amount of work.
When you say localize, you mean translate it into other languages?
Translate it into other languages. But then, of course, you know, it's more than just translating, like the notes, for instance. The notes in the English versions usually refer to English translations, and it doesn't make sense to translate those into Spanish. So the right. Spanish localizer has to look at a number of Spanish resources and see how relevant that note is. And yeah, there's a lot of work in that. So that's why I call it localization, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I guess you're familiar with those volumes on the prepositions where they categorized them all. I forget the author's name.
Ernst Jenny.
Yeah. Do you think those will be of any use?
Actually, there's a story behind that. Yeah, I have those books. And I was pretty excited. And I thought to myself, well, you know, this approach is very pretty close to cognitive. And so I wrote a letter to Professor Yen years ago, and I asked him, you know, explained a little bit of what I was doing, whether I could use his resources. And he wrote back and he said, well, you know, he didn't care much for cognitive linguistics, but he was totally fine if I used the resources. So what I did with, I started with Bö, and I went to use his book, and I kind of scanned his analysis. He has this list of all the references and where what meaning is there. So I scanned the whole thing and I got it in the computer and actually wrote an article on it, on Bö. Bö is in the lexicon. I have never released that entry, but it's there following Yeni's analysis pretty closely and giving him credit, of course. So yeah, that is going to be a possible solution for those prepositions. And I'm planning on using it. I would have to finish Bö and do the same thing with K and L and so on. So trusting that his analysis works. And with Bö, it worked pretty well. I was able to assign lexical domains to them. And that helps quite a bit.
Yeah. So you said you wrote an article on Bö. Where can we find that?
I presented a paper on Bö. That's what I did at one of the SBL meetings. I'm not sure whether I ever published it.
Okay, fascinating. I would love to read it if you post it on your academia profile.
Okay, yeah. I'll have to look it up whether I can still find it.
This brings me to volunteers. How can someone help you? Are you looking for help? What kind of help?
Well, there are still some people who are also working on the key terms of the Old Testament project in SBL, like Anne Compaore. She has been working also on SDBH. She's kind of doing both at the same time. And so, yeah, occasionally it helps. At this moment, of course, we are getting closer and closer to the end. And yeah, at this moment, when people come to me and say, can I work on this? 9 out of 10 cases, I have to tell them, well, it has already been done. Sorry. But what I would love to see, of course, is that people will start using it critically and come with questions and comments. You know, this database, this dictionary or lexicon, whatever you call it, will never be completely finished because there is no end. It's an electronic publication. There's nothing that's keeping us from adding, improving. So what I would love to see is that people would, you know, yeah, look at it, start using it. And that's already happening. The Psalms Layer by Layer project that you undoubtedly know about, they're using SDBH as their base for their analysis of the Psalms. So yeah, almost every week they come with me and say, well, we saw that you want to analyze this here. Could it also be done like this and like that? And then we have a discussion. And sometimes I change my analysis. And so that's what I would love to see, that scholars around the world, they work with me and continue developing the database until it really refined, improved, all these things. Yeah.
Now, what is the process? I know you've done this already for your dictionary in Spanish and French and some other languages. You've translated a good portion of it. What is the process for doing that? How does that work? Are people doing that as volunteers? And then what kind of interface do they use to do that? Do they just use like an Excel doc or?
There's two ways to do it. I wrote myself a little application that helps them do it. It goes through every entry and they can click on a word and they can look it up in different translations that are made available to them. And then everything is stored in Dropbox. And every week, the end of every week, at a certain time, I tell people, stop working, guys, and I harvest whatever work they have done. For those who are not very comfortable with it, I export everything into an Excel worksheet, and I give it to them. And they are making the change in Excel, and at the end of the day, I import everything again, and then we have a localization. So that works. It's a little bit more tedious to, if you really want to engage with the scripture text at the background, that's not very handy from Excel, but it's not impossible. There's also links on the Excel sheet to the website, so they can look things up on the website and get some background information from there.
Okay, that's great. So you have, how many languages now has it been translated into partially?
Okay, well, we have the full versions in English, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Chinese. We are working on Russian, very close to be finished. We are working on Swahili. We are working on 8 languages from India. We're working on, wow. Did I mention Arabic? Not yet. We're planning to work on 2 languages in the Philippines. And I may have forgotten 1 or 2, but there's a lot of work going on.
Okay. How do you decide which languages to prioritize? Is it just whoever comes along who's qualified and willing in that language, or are there certain strategies you follow?
Well, you know, some of these languages are gateway languages. Different agencies have determined what are gateway languages and which languages really have priority. I try to follow that as much as I can. But then, you know, you work also with contacts that you have and where you believe you can find people that can do the work. So it's a mix of those, yeah, pragmatic concerns and also, you know, the opportunities that come your way.
Well, thank you so much for this amazing talk. It's been so helpful and so interesting. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Andrew. It's always great to talk about these things. Absolutely.